Hello everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I am your host, Tony, and today we are going to look at Shadowcaster, a first-person action role-playing game developed by Raven Software and published by Origin Systems in 1993 on floppy disk, with a CD version following in 1994, both of which were for the Microsoft DOS computer platform. We will begin talking about that game in just a couple minutes, but first, as is customary, we have just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 16. We are continuing to have fun and build and grow a community. I'm incredibly excited with what we're doing so far. If anybody would like to reach out and either give me suggestions about future episodes or talk about prior episodes or talk about gaming or technology or pretty much anything in between, there are a couple ways that you can reach out to me. I do have an email address, which is classicgamingtoday@gmail.com. I also have a Twitter account with the handle @classicgamingt. So feel free to drop me a line, reach out. I am definitely interested in having any sort of discussion with all of you about classic gaming in general. For anybody who may be new, welcome. I do just want to take a brief moment to go over the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, every single episode that we do follows a similar form and structure. First, we will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context, how the game was made, why the game was made, what the developers were thinking when they actually put code to screen and created the experience. After we're done talking about the history, we will go into a pseudo-review kind of section. I call it a pseudo-review because it's not really like a numerical ranking or things like that, but we do look at each game from several different perspectives, such as the graphics, how does the game look? Sound music, how does the game sound? What are the sound effects like? The narrative and or story, if the game has one, playability and controls, and the overall feel of playing the game today versus when it was released originally, however many years ago. We do all that in order to reach a verdict to determine if the game still holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of the mountain is the pantheon of classic gaming. If the game that we're talking about reaches the pantheon, you are guaranteed to have a good time with it. It is that darn good. It is a true classic. You should not miss this. You should go out and play it right now. Highly recommended from my perspective. It is just as good today as it was however many years ago. Just beyond the pantheon are our golden oldies. These are the games that, they don't really quite reach that pantheon level. They're close, but not quite at the pantheon level. They're still really good games, particularly if you enjoy the genre or you have nostalgia for the game in question. Feel free to play it again or to play it for the first time. They're really good games. I still highly recommend any game that falls into the golden oldie category, but they don't quite reach that pantheon level for any number of reasons. Could be that they didn't age quite as gracefully as the pantheon games, or maybe there were one or a couple issues there that just detract from the experience a little bit. Beyond the golden oldies, we get to our mediocre mentions. These are the games where we start getting into the, I don't know that I can recommend these for the general population to play. They may still be fun for you if you have a particular fondness for the genre or nostalgia for the game itself, but if you don't, you may not have as good of a time. These games are ones that may have aged a little bit more poorly than some of the other titles that we look at, or they might have had some issues up front that were in there right from the point that they were delivered and just don't hold up quite as well today. And then finally, we have the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend you play these games at all. You certainly could try if you want to. I can't control you, nor would I want to. But these are not games that hold up at all. They have either aged very poorly, or they may just have not been that great of a game to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day, that being Shadowcaster. Thank you. Shadowcaster, like we mentioned, is a first-person action role-playing game developed by Raven Software and published by Origin Systems, released in 1993 on floppy disk and 1994 on CD. Shadowcaster is itself an incredibly interesting piece of gaming history, and it's almost a perfect example of a bridge between multiple genres and technological advancements. If that's the case, then why isn't it really thought of all that much when one thinks about either first-person games or RPGs of the time? I would venture a guess and say, you ask anybody from that era that grew up with computer games around that time, and they may not talk to you about Shadowcaster. Why is that? Well, to answer that question, we have to take a look at the state of the industry back in the late 80s and early 90s, and we're going to start by discussing the computer RPG or role-playing game landscape of the time. So, if we're talking about computer RPGs back then, generally speaking, there were two different styles, and this is a little bit of a generalization, but for the most part, you can think of computer-based RPGs of the late 80s, early 90s as one of two broad styles. The first was focused on top-down, kind of overhead view graphics, and the other was a first-person perspective with grid-based dungeon crawling and all that kind of stuff. So let me explain a little bit. The first style of RPG with the top-down graphics, typically you could almost think of them as a little bit like a Final Fantasy kind of game, in that you see the world around you, you see the character or characters in your party, and you move them around the world or dungeon from that top-down kind of view. In that way, you see your characters every time you move them around, they probably are sprite-based, and generally speaking, when you move around the game world, each of the game world elements or the game world itself are usually made of blocks of sprites, which are effectively background tiles or tiles of terrain or dungeons or things like that. A lot of times when you would walk around a game like that, you would see your enemies also represented in sprite-based form. And as you approach those enemies, you might enter into battle and try to defeat them. Some RPGs were turn-based, others were more active kind of combat where you would pick different options for attacking or spell casting and defeat them. The second type of RPG that was prevalent around this time was the first-person grid-based dungeon crawling kind of experience. What this kind of game was focused on is rather than seeing your character on the screen, you would have a first-person perspective into the game world. And a lot of times this wasn't something where you would navigate the game world via a traditional first-person shooter kind of experience, meaning you wouldn't necessarily move around a smooth game world like you would in, say, Wolfenstein 3D or Doom, but rather you would have that first-person view into the game world and you would then click an arrow or press an arrow on your keyboard, which then you would move forward a screen, so to speak. And each of the dungeons that were part of these RPGs were typically laid out in a grid fashion, which meant it lent themselves to being able to create maps of the experience. And by the way, if you play any of these early RPGs, you will need to map out these dungeons yourself. There were a couple games that actually had auto-mapping software built into the experience. A lot of them did not, and most of those dungeons are incredibly maze-like. So it really was something that focused on exploration and trying to navigate the environment and really keeping track of where you were manually with an actual piece of paper and a pencil versus being handed the map or an auto-mapping kind of function built into the game itself. Typically speaking, most computer RPGs, while they may have differed graphically or the overall style from that standpoint, a lot of the games had very similar features as well. Most RPGs allowed some degree of character creation. Sometimes you could even create your full party, and a lot of times that involved choosing classes or assigning skill points and attribute points. Some games even allowed you to choose which spells you would learn as part of the character creation process. Most RPGs of the time also involved or had a leveling system where, as you would combat various enemies and monsters, you would gain experience, you would gain levels, and be able to allocate even more attribute points as you would level up. A lot of them did have grinding in some capacity, meaning that rather than being able to just have a smooth experience and just progress through the game without any sort of hindrance, you may hit a certain point in the game where you have to take a step back. You can't progress the story because you need additional experience levels. So you'd have to go off and you'd have to grind experience on mobs and try to get those extra levels before you'd be able to progress the main storyline of the game. Typical of RPGs at the time also were inventory management, so you'd have to manage your inventory, and different games had different styles for inventory management. Some of them had a menu-based system, others had more of a visual representation where you'd actually have to organize your inventory and the items that you would pick up from the game world. And similarly, you'd have to manage your party if the game did in fact have a party that you would be controlling. Rather than just controlling your main character, for games that had parties, particularly in the first-person dungeon crawler kind of experience, you would often have to assign actions to each of your party members. Similarly, with the tops-down kind of view, you would have control over those characters and be able to assign them different actions in the battles that you would encounter. And then, of course, there were other items that are pretty much typical of every single RPG ever released. Things like acquiring loot as you continue through the game, getting new and varied equipment that you'd be able to equip on your characters, learning spells. We mentioned the complex dungeon maps, especially for the first-person perspective games. Very complex. You really did need to make maps. I'm not joking. I said it multiple times because it's really true if you ever go back to play one of those games. And most of the RPGs around this time had very complex systems that interacted with each other. We talked about spells, inventory systems, class-based systems, attribute points, levels, skills. There were all sorts of complex systems that interacted with each other. And the reason for that is that a lot of the RPGs in the late 80s, early 90s, specifically or especially on computers, took inspiration from Dungeons & Dragons, which was a popular tabletop game that had come out years prior. So a lot of those games also had different races that you could be, once again, taking inspiration from Dungeons & Dragons. And most of the games had turn-based gameplay. And we talked a little bit about turn-based gameplay during the Chrono Trigger episode, but effectively, none or very few of the RPGs that were released around this time actually had real-time battles. Basically, you would take a turn, or your entire party would take a turn, and then the enemies would take a turn, and then it would bounce back to you, and you would do your moves, and they would do their moves, and it would bounce back and forth, almost like a tennis match, where you'd have the ball, you'd be able to take whatever moves you were able to take, either via the action points that you had available to you, or the time that was assigned to you, or maybe it was just literally a one move, one turn kind of thing, and then once you finish that, it would go to the enemy and vice versa. So there really wasn't active battles or real-time battles happening in most computer RPGs of the time. I will say, generally speaking, people playing computer RPGs relished that complexity, and they often looked at any attempt to interject action or real-time combative elements into the experience to be inferior or too arcade and Nintendo-like. We talked a little bit about the disparity and difference between console-based RPGs and computer RPGs, and as we discussed during our Chrono Trigger episode, Japan console RPGs like Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest had taken inspiration from computer RPGs like Wizardry and Ultima to create those experiences for the console. And then those experiences, those console RPGs, would eventually evolve into their own unique genre. The opposite wasn't really true. Not many people looked to the more action-oriented console gameplay as an opportunity to evolve the state of the computer RPG. For one, because of the perception that that would make the experience less complex, and like I said, RPG players love their complexity, and two, because action-based gameplay was assumed to more or less require gamepads, which weren't really used much at the time on computers. There were some controllers and gamepads available for the PC, but for the most part, when you're talking about a PC game, and especially when you're talking about PC or computer RPGs, the control elements that you typically use are the mouse and the keyboard. I will say, though, that the computer RPG market was pretty varied, but there were two big heavyweights on the market, that being the Ultima series and the Wizardry series. And generally speaking, these two games represented the two different styles of gameplay we discussed previously. Ultima historically had been a third-person tops-down view of the world, while Wizardry had historically presented its world as a first-person window into the game's environments and varied dungeons. Both, however, were traditional turn-based RPG experiences. Both games also were incredibly successful, and really that applies to pretty much every game in both of their series, were both very, very successful and very influential. And they spawned numerous sequels, and they garnered a significant amount of fans who delighted in the complexity of their game worlds and interacting gameplay systems to create deep, immersive experiences. With all that, though, comes competition. And whenever you're successful, whenever you have a lot of success, that breeds competition, and there were a number of companies that wanted to try to evolve the computer RPG genre. One of those companies was a group called FTL Games, who in 1987 released their take on a computer RPG when they created Dungeon Master for the Atari ST system. At a glance, Dungeon Master would look similar to other computer RPGs of the time. It had a first-person interface, traditional party management, loot gathering, and dungeon crawler mechanics. One of the things that made it unique, however, was the introduction of real-time combat versus the more common turn-based approach many RPGs of the time implemented. Now, I will say, this wasn't the first real-time first-person combat RPG ever created, but it was the one that really popularized the concepts and drove others to try to implement their own games utilizing similar gameplay elements. One of those companies that was inspired by Dungeon Master and wanted to create their own RPG experience was Raven Software, founded in 1990 by brothers Brian and Steve Raffel. As a small three-person company, they set out to create their first game, a computer RPG called Black Crypt, that would be released on the Amiga computer platform in 1992. Black Crypt would represent a natural evolution of the Dungeon Master framework, with improved graphics, more complex game systems, and smoother real-time combat, all using a pseudo-3D first-person perspective. While I can't confirm Raven Software's motivations, it certainly appears to be directly inspired by Dungeon Master. I'd also be remiss in not addressing the fact that other RPG developers were similarly inspired by Dungeon Master, with Ultima Underworld: The Stygian Abyss releasing in 1992, around the same time as Black Crypt was released. Ultima Underworld, by contrast, represented the first true 3D first-person environment in an RPG, meaning there weren't any clever graphics tricks or 2D stretching perspective algorithms in play. The environment in Ultima Underworld was a fully developed 3D environment, and also included a number of advanced graphical features that made it one of, if not the, most advanced 3D engine released up to that point. That being said, any degree of playable performance required an absolute beast of a system. I mean, I know we've talked about, well, we haven't talked about, but gamers and gaming culture in general used to talk about Crysis. And they would used to talk about your computer systems in terms of, could it play Crysis? Maybe it could, maybe it couldn't, but what I do know is that most computers of the time back in the early 90s could not run Ultima Underworld: Stygian Abyss without significant performance impacts. Still, independent of that, and independent of the fact that it was a very processor and CPU and computer intensive kind of software, the technology was amazing at the time. Tangent aside, Raven Software's work on Black Crypt would eventually draw the attention of others in the industry, most notably the crew over at id Software, who we've talked about a little bit before. When we had last spoke about id Software, they had just released Wolfenstein 3D and set the world on fire with what was effectively the grandfather of modern first-person shooters. After that release, John Carmack was looking at how he could potentially evolve that original Wolfenstein 3D engine to create something even better. And as many developers often did, he began experimenting with technological advancements to form the basis of a new engine that represented the evolution of the Wolfenstein 3D engine. Let's recall that Wolfenstein 3D, while technologically impressive at the time, still had some limitations. It utilized texture mapping, but didn't have texture-mapped floors or ceilings. They were all plain colors. So when you would navigate in a world in Wolfenstein 3D, the walls would have texture. They might be a brick wall or a wooden wall, and you would see those textures on the screen. But if you looked at the ceiling or you looked at the floor, they were all just plain shades of colors, so they didn't really have texture mapping for the entire environment. Additionally, the Wolfenstein 3D engine couldn't render sloped floors. All of the walls were also the same height, and lighting and levels were pretty much only set to one setting, which was constantly bright. In comparison to Ultima Underworld's engine, it was missing some key features, although it was a much faster engine. It was able to perform much better, albeit with much less detail. Addressing those feature gaps, John Carmack's next engine would include fully texture-mapped environments, including ceilings and floors, walls of varying heights, meaning rooms and environments could have much more diverse layouts. It also included sloped floors and a full-scale lighting system that would allow for darker environments in addition to areas with brighter lighting. With all of those advancements, however, there was one big trade-off. The overall speed of the engine was around half the performance of Wolfenstein 3D. John Carmack couldn't use the engine in its current iteration for his next big first-person shooter project. He just did not want to lose the speed. He believed, and I believe rightly so, that a first-person shooter needed to have a certain amount of speed in order to really be an effective experience. And he did not want to compromise on the speed of his engine for id Software's first-person shooter titles. But that was actually okay, as John Carmack was looking at this particular engine as a prototype. It was meant to be an interim step between Wolfenstein 3D and what Carmack's next big project was going to be. But if that engine was used for a different style of game rather than an id-style fast-paced first-person shooter, it could still potentially serve a purpose. Recognizing Raven Software's original RPG creation, id decided to license this prototype engine to Raven for use in their next game, which was going to be a real-time RPG where the decreased speed of the engine wouldn't be as much of a hindrance. That game is what would eventually evolve into Shadowcaster. With the evolved Wolfenstein 3D engine available to them, the Shadowcaster team set off to create their new RPG, which would serve as both an evolution of their prior game, Black Crypt, while at the same time evolving the state of first-person RPGs in general. As discussed previously, typical computer RPGs were highly complex, turn-based affairs. Shadowcaster would represent a shift to a more action-driven first-person RPG, with even more focus on the speed of combat while simplifying the underlying mechanics to a much more streamlined experience. The game would focus on a single protagonist as opposed to a party of companions who didn't require any allocation of attributes or other character creation features. Rather than navigating a complex world full of cities, dungeons, and other locations, the focus here was squarely on dungeon crawling, with numerous environmental hazards, enemy types, and loot to pick up and use along the way. Each level of the dungeon provided an opportunity for exploration as well as combat, and secret areas that required a certain combination of skills and navigation added a degree of mystery to the whole experience. And it did all of these things using a relatively fast-paced engine that lent itself to RPG-based action combat, that being the prototype engine that was created after Wolfenstein 3D. Now, that's not to say that the game was an entirely simplistic affair. In fact, it did have a class system of sorts, but it implemented it via shape-shifting abilities that could be found in various levels throughout the game. Each different creature that you could shape-shift into would give you different skills, spells, and abilities, effectively giving the player the freedom to figure out how best to proceed through the game without pigeonholing them into a predefined class selection at the beginning of the game. Some shapes could even punch through breakable walls, introducing an early example of rudimentary destructible environments into the game. Shadowcaster also included a degree of vertical movement, with some shapes that you could shapeshift into even having the ability to fly through levels. Underwater movement and combat was also introduced, with certain shapes having advantages in the environment, while others, like the cat-based Maurin, drowning quickly by just touching the water. It is true that cats don't like water, but still, instantaneous death or near instantaneous death might have been a little bit harsh. Now, as you can see, the team was setting out to create a simplified, but not simple, experience. Development of the game proceeded on schedule until finally in 1993 it was released to players worldwide on 3.5-inch floppy disks, with a CD-ROM version adding animated cutscenes and voice acting following in 1994. Interestingly, while the game was developed by Raven Software, it was published by Origin Systems, which was the company behind, you guessed it, the Ultima series. Upon its release, Shadowcaster was met with nearly universal critical acclaim. Many critics praised the fast-paced combat and indicated that they loved the fact that this was an RPG that could be played by people who weren't deep into numbers and tons of interconnected complex systems, dice rolls, and things like that. This was effectively an RPG for the masses, a hack-and-slash affair that represented a simplified experience while still capturing the essence of what RPGs were all about. In fact, there were some reviews that actually said, hey, you know, this is a great RPG. It doesn't require a math degree to figure out, because like we were talking about, a lot of the computer RPGs of this time were just highly complex, and you needed almost spreadsheets in order to figure out all of the different stats and how stats would affect your hit points and your ability to hit enemies or the amount of damage you would do. They were really complex systems and really complex games. Shadowcaster simplified that dramatically while still delivering a kind of RPG-lite experience. Shadowcaster would also go on to be included on several publications' best games of all time lists and would prove to be popular amongst players as well. Shadowcaster was Raven Software's second game, and it was an undeniable success. Its legacy, however, would extend well beyond its release. As noted earlier, Shadowcaster was a bridge between genres and technologies. Many of the features of the engine would form the foundation of id Software's next engine, that being the technology behind the first-person shooter Doom. In fact, id Software would be so impressed with the game that it would license the Doom engine to Raven Software to create a future title, which itself represented a natural evolution from the RPG underpinnings of Shadowcaster into an even more fast-paced, action-driven game. John Carmack recognized the goodness of the RPG elements, but wanted the team to make a game with more focus on action. He literally told the team, "Do it like Doom and add the fantasy flavor." That direction is what led to the creation of the Heretic and Hexen series of gothic medieval first-person shooters. While Shadowcaster might not be quite as well remembered today as Ultima, Wizardry, and Heretic, it was undoubtedly an important release in computer gaming history. It represented a key step in the evolution of both first-person perspective games as well as the action RPG genre, and its quality cannot be denied. While it never spawned a direct sequel, it was an inspiration to numerous games that followed, and proved Raven Software, even early in its history, was a talented developer with a bright future ahead of it. We may talk about Raven Software's continued contributions to the gaming industry, but that will be a story for another time. We are now going to transition into talking more about Shadowcaster and how it feels to play the game today versus when it was released back in 1993. So just as a reminder, Shadowcaster was released in 1993. It is a first-person action role-playing game. And what does that mean when we say first-person action RPG? Because over the years, there have been a number of action RPGs, or at least games that have been classified as action RPGs, that have been released. So what does it mean when we say first-person action RPG, at least as it relates to Shadowcaster? So, if we're talking about the gameplay, basically the way this worked is it was pure hack-and-slash gameplay. You would navigate maze-like environments, and the dungeons were, or I should say the game, had multiple levels across its dungeon environments. And you would go through all of these different maze-like environments, and you would basically hack and slash your way through all of the enemies. There'd be some rudimentary puzzle elements in there that you might have to figure out. But for the most part, it was not a complex, numbers-driven kind of game. Like most RPGs of the time, it was really much more in-your-face and much more action. You also had a lot of control over your characters as well, because you were able to actually click the mouse and have actions happen immediately versus having to wait for turn-based battle kinds of scenarios. There were 18 main levels in the game, and they covered a variety of environmental types. There were ruins that you would explore. There were temples, lava tunnels, underground flooded caverns, and other kinds of environments that you would expect to see in a dungeon crawling kind of experience. It was pretty varied, and the environments were very varied in comparison to a lot of other games at the time. There was also a variety of different enemies that you would encounter, some of which would be traditional ground-based enemies. Others might be flying enemies that would literally fly around the level, and you may have to actually fly up to them in order to attack them. There were some enemies that had certain immunities to different elements, like would be able to walk on fire or lava. There were other enemies that had projectile attacks. Other enemies could swim in the water. There were just a large variety of enemies, and the bestiary for Shattercaster was pretty large. There were some items that were included in the game world that you could pick up. Some of those were limited use, like health and mana potions, where once you use them a certain amount of time, they would disappear from your inventory forever, or more accurately, they would be depleted, and then you could leave the empty bottles all around the game world and litter the environment because you couldn't use those bottles anymore. I did mention there were some light puzzles that would need to be solved. There were various weapons and equipment that you could pick up, though I will say, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, I didn't really feel that dramatic of a difference when picking up different weapons and equipment. I'm sure the equipment, like the chest armor and various pieces of defensive gear that I was able to pick up, I'm sure it had an impact, but it just didn't feel very impactful. It was not like when you play a traditional RPG and you get a brand new piece of equipment or a brand new sword and you feel demonstrably more powerful than you did before. A lot of the equipment in this game, at least from my perspective during my playthrough, didn't really feel like it had that significant of an impact in comparison to what you might see with other RPGs. Now, this game did have a level up system, so over time, as you would gain experience and beat various enemies, you would eventually level up, but there was no attribute or skills-based system at play, so you didn't have to manage attributes or assign points to strength or intelligence for magic usage or anything like that. It was much simpler. You would level up and you would gain some hit points, you'd gain some mana. And that was pretty much it. You probably also gained some power, so to speak, in that you probably became a little bit more effective in combat, but it wasn't like you were managing attributes or assigning skill points or trying to build out various skill trees to learn more skills and learn more spells and things like that. It just wasn't that kind of a game. It was a much simpler kind of experience from a leveling perspective. Beyond those core elements, the biggest draw in the game was the shape-shifting mechanic. We'll talk about why you can actually shapeshift when we get to talk about the story of the game, but just to give everybody a brief description of the various shapes that you get throughout the game, because the way the game works is you begin by basically or simply just being yourself, and you are a humanoid kind of character, and then as you explore the game world and continue to progress through the various levels, you will acquire additional shapes that you can shift into. And all of those shapes are just basically creatures. They're different creatures that you can shapeshift into, and all of them have their own skills, strengths, and weaknesses. So this is why when we were talking earlier about the fact that the game doesn't have a class-based system, so to speak, but the individual shapes and creatures that you can change into did, in fact, represent different classes to a degree. So even though you weren't, say, picking a fighter class or a cleric class or a wizard kind of class, by switching or shapeshifting into these different creatures, you would effectively gain the skills of those classes, albeit without actually choosing a class or being called one of the more traditional kinds of classes that you'd see in RPGs. So let's talk about the individual shapes or the individual creatures that you can shapeshift into. The very first is simply you as a humanoid, and your name is Kurt. That is the default character in the game, and the best way to describe Kurt is that he's basically weak. I mean, all of his abilities are pretty much weak. He does have some fighting skill, and his form is the only form in which magic rejuvenates. So I did mention that you have hit points and you have mana points that you will gain throughout the game. And while you can pick up health and magic potions to regenerate some of your hit points or mana, you could also, there are certain forms that will allow you to regenerate some of that, some of the either the hit points or the mana points just automatically by sitting around. Curt is the only form in which you can actually rejuvenate your mana points. So from that perspective, it's a useful form. I just would never use Curt, the base form, as anything once you start getting the other shapes. Once you get your first shape, I never found a reason to use Curt again other than to rejuvenate magic. I will say that health also rejuvenates while you're playing as Curt within his default humanoid shape, but it recovers or it rejuvenates much slower than magic does, and there are other forms which have more effective healing. So for me, once you get the first shape, Curt becomes kind of a magic mana battery, so to speak, where after you get done a particularly difficult fight, if you have a few minutes, you want to go get a drink or something, just switch over to Curt, sit him in a corner, and regenerate your mana. And that's pretty much the best way, or the only way that I used him throughout the majority of the game. The first shape that you get that's not Curt is called the Maorin. And this is pretty useful as soon as you get it. It is probably the most useful shape that you get early in the game. So the Maorin is a large, four-armed, cat-like creature, and it has superior fighting skills as well as the ability to see things that are invisible to others. So this is kind of a cat-like form, and as soon as I got this shape, I shelved Curt for the majority of the game. And for a lot of the game, I actually played as the Maorin almost exclusively, because a lot of the game has really direct, in-your-face combat. We were talking a little bit about the fact that this is a much more action-paced or fast-paced kind of RPG-ish light kind of experience, in that you would get basically in the enemy's faces and you would swing away until you either beat them or they beat you. The Maorin was a very strong melee fighter, and generally speaking, when I play RPGs, I tend towards melee. I do sometimes play magic-based classes, but I find that melee classes really speak to me a little bit more. So as soon as I got the Maorin form, that was pretty much what I ended up using for a large portion of the game as I continued to move through the levels. So it was very effective. It's a very powerful melee fighter and made a lot of the fights a lot easier than certainly than trying to use Curt, who was not that strong and really was reliant on weapons. I should probably mention that each of the forms have their own inventory. So it was kind of interesting because the game does not have multiple characters, so to speak, in that you're not managing a party of characters. But each of the shapes that you could shift into had their own distinct inventory, and they have their own unique skills and strengths and weaknesses. So even though it's not a party-based game, and even though it's not a multiple character or class kind of experience, it almost kind of is. It's like you control multiple characters at different points. It just so happens that it's all the same person, so to speak, albeit shifted into different shapes and different forms. So something just to consider, even though it wasn't billed as a multiple character game or a multiple class kind of game, it kind of is just based on the design, but it almost hides that element behind the shape-shifting mechanic. The only other thing I want to mention about the Maorin, I did mention that they have the ability to see things that are invisible to others. That becomes incredibly important in a couple levels where there are some invisible traps that you actually have to use your invisibility viewing capability. Otherwise, you will get absolutely wrecked. So it's a good thing that that class in particular has that skill. The one weakness for the Maorin is that it does drown very quickly. I mentioned earlier the little joke about cats drowning and not liking water. Well, the Maorin is the class that will absolutely die if you spend any period of time in water. And I'm not even just talking about underwater. Just if you're in the water, it takes immediate damage and will die very quickly. Moving on, the next form that you have the opportunity to shift into is called the Khan or Khan. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. I guess it would be Khan, because effectively it's a leprechaun-like creature who is not a great fighter, but this is your healer. This is the class that can heal very quickly. So it's effectively your cleric. It also has the ability to jump over obstacles and fit into smaller spaces, and also has some rudimentary magic. It can unleash a swarm of insects as one of the spells that you can cast. And the one thing I found interesting there is that there is actually a particular door later on in the game where you have to cast this swarm of insects in order to progress into the game. There were some minor hints that that was something that was going to be needed embedded within the game world, but that was a little bit of a stretch. Regardless, you have the ability, and the Khan does have that ability. But really, the way I use this class mostly, or the way I use this form mostly, was for healing. If I had significant damage, I could switch over to the Khan and I could heal up relatively quickly. It also had a shield spell that I guess would be usable if you were trying to fight with the character. I never really fought with this particular shape, so I didn't really use the shield spell at all. It just didn't feel like an effective use of time to use this particular class or this particular form to fight enemies. So I never really got much use out of the shield spell. But it did have something that was a little bit useful, and that was a light spell. So it could actually light up the environment around it and make it easier to see, which once again is one of those skills that becomes useful at different points throughout the game. You could see, as you play through the game, by the way, you could see how each of these individual forms were designed for a specific reason and for a specific sort of section or multiple sections in the game in order to allow the player to progress through. So even though the game didn't force fit you into a single class, so to speak, it did kind of make you think about what particular shape you should be using in different scenarios, because there were certain spots in the game that you basically had to be certain shapes in order to progress, at least progress well. You could probably progress through most of the game using any class if for any form if you're good at it, but would be definitely and infinitely more difficult. Now, one of the other cool things about the Khan is that it could magically reach out and take objects which are far away. So if there were objects farther away that you couldn't navigate to for whatever reason, whether there was a barrier or obstacle in your way, or if you couldn't get there because there were enemies kind of standing in your path, you would be able to use a special spell that could pull those objects closer to you. The next form that you could shapeshift into is known as the Opsis, which is a hovering brain with tentacles that can use spells pretty effectively. This is basically like your wizard kind of class. It had spells like fireballs and icy blasts, so it was very traditional kind of wizardish spells. It is able to fly and hover in the air, but it moves very slowly in the air. And this is one of those classes where I basically barely ever used it. I think I used it, and there were a couple sections where you had to fly, and I basically used it. And flying is probably a little bit too strong of a term. It really was more of a hover, kind of a very slow float through the air versus a fly through the air. One of the things I do want to mention about the game, which I did find interesting, is I mentioned earlier that there was a degree of verticality in the game. And certainly with your normal characters, you can kind of jump a little bit, and that affects your verticality a little bit. But with your flying or hovering characters, you could actually hit there's like a plus button on the screen, and it would actually raise your level from a vertical distance perspective. So you can fly all the way on the ceiling, and you could also pick a spot in between the ceiling and the floor and kind of pick the amount of height that you would have as you're flying around. It was an interesting mechanic. It wasn't used, or at least I didn't use it all that much. I did have to use it with some navigation of certain tricky areas and starting to fight some enemies that were also flying kinds of enemies. I think they probably could have done a little bit more with that, but it was an interesting mechanic nonetheless. Moving on to the next shape you can be is the Kappa, which was a decent fighter. The big thing about this particular shape is that you're able to breathe underwater, which is instrumental in certain areas because there are some underwater environments and underwater levels that you have to navigate, and you pretty much need this particular shape or form to be able to navigate those underwater environments effectively. It did have a couple of skills. There was one that was sonic-based, so you could kind of shoot a sonic wave at your enemies, and you could also utilize an electrical attack. Now, the interesting thing here is that you can use those skills at any point, whether you're on land or in the water. But if you use those skills in the water, they become extra powerful. And you would kind of expect that, especially from the electrical attack, where electricity and water, generally speaking, do not mix, especially if it's being directed at an enemy. So I thought it was interesting that they built that into the game, where the different skills could have different levels of effectiveness depending on what environment you were in. And certainly being in the water and using electricity, that was something that allowed you to be a little bit extra powerful and really made that character useful or more useful in that kind of environment. Moving on to the next class that you can find is the Sire, which is a hovering dragon with no legs, but it had a pretty strong attack. It was actually one of the stronger forms that I found in the game. The only downside is that it had a weak defense. So rather than the Meroian, which was pretty balanced between defense and offense, the Sire was very strong, probably stronger than the Meroian, but had a much weaker defense, so it was not nearly as well balanced than the Meroian. Although, I will say that some of the cool stuff that it can do, it could breathe fire and could also use its tail as a weapon. Now, this particular form was a very fast flyer, and one of the other cool aspects of this class is that as you navigate the world, you will encounter enemy-based Sires, and if you are this form as you approach them, they will not attack you. Normally, those particular characters or those particular enemies are hostile, but if you are in that form, if you're in that dragon form and you approach them, they basically just go about their business. They will ignore you, which once again opens up some additional strategy as you're navigating some of these levels. You may be able to avoid fights entirely based on what form you have selected. And then finally, there is one final form that you will get near the very end of the game, and that's known as the Grost or Grost. Once again, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce all of these different shapes, but that creature or that form is basically a man that's made of stone. It is a very strong fighter with very strong defense. This is probably the strongest melee-based character in the game, and once I got it, I don't think I changed to anything else. This was my favorite by far. It could also punch through certain walls. So I mentioned earlier that there was some destructibility in the environments that was built into the game. This particular form was able to punch through walls, which would open up different areas of levels that you'd be able to explore. It was also able to walk on lava without taking any sort of damage because being stone, it wasn't really impacted or affected by the hot lava or the fire in the various levels. It can also, as far as skills go, it's able to cause earthquakes, which doesn't sound like, well, I guess it sounds like it would be useful, but in practice wasn't terribly useful. There were a couple of areas, though, especially near the end of the game, where there are certain sections where you face a lot of flying enemies at one time, and being able to use that earthquake to affect all of them at the same time was definitely very useful. And there's also another skill that this particular form has that allows you to paralyze any foes with just a mere touch, which once again, very useful, especially if you're being this particular form and you're trying to fight flying enemies, that can get a little tricky at times. So the skills for the Grost felt like they were pretty well balanced and really did help augment the fact that this primarily melee-based fighter was able to hold his own with some of the other magic-based elements. So I know we went into a lot of detail about those shapes and what shapes you can shift into, but I did that because that really is the main mechanic of the game. And in order to understand the game itself and to talk about the overall quality of the game and the quality of the experience, you really need to understand that core mechanic, because like I said, that is really something that you're going to be doing and using the entire game. So I did want to spend a little bit of additional time talking through those shapes so that everybody had that base level of understanding. So before we go into the more specific review-like sections and talk about graphics, sound, narrative, all that good stuff, I do want to take a look at the back of the box because, as always, first of all, I love the boxes. I love big box computer games. I love boxes in general with games because I feel like it just kind of paints an interesting story that helps to sell the overall experience. Because a lot of times back when these games were coming out, we didn't necessarily have tons of magazines with articles that we could reference, or we didn't have the internet that we can go look up gameplay videos. So a lot of times when we would buy a game, it would be based off of what the back of the box said or what the box itself looked like. So for Shadowcaster, the back of the box says, "In Shadowcaster, you have the ultimate power. Morph at will into six shapes to aid in your quest against evil. Fly, swim, and run through caverns, castles, mines, and underwater caves. Relentless combat awaits you at every turn. Features the most outstanding 3D art ever seen in any point-of-view game." And then there are basically the same exact text but in different languages along the back of the box, and a number of screenshots that show different environments and experiences from the game. So that's how Shadowcaster sold itself if you were to walk up to the box on a store shelf and look at it without knowing anything about it. So once again, the biggest draw here probably is the shape-shifting mechanic, which we will get into now how it feels to actually use as we start going into the reviews. But before we get to that, we do have to start with graphics. So the game's graphics can best be described as evocative. If you look at the game today, and if you look at it from today's perspective, you can certainly see that it is an older title. But the environments, the characters, the items, the paper dolls, so to speak, of you yourself as you shift through the different shapes that you have the opportunity to utilize, everything looked good. And it truly did evoke the feeling of navigating a complex dungeon-based world. It did, I will admit. It took maybe a level or two for me to become immersed in the world, and a large part of that, and the reason why I did eventually become immersed, was because of the quality and style demonstrated by the graphics. I actually really enjoyed the design, and for whatever reason, and this kind of happened throughout the game, and I'll touch upon this a little bit as we continue to move forward. For some reason, this game, even though it was early, kind of reminded me a little bit of the original EverQuest, which was a massively multiplayer online RPG released in the late 90s. And I don't know why, but as I was playing Shadowcaster, and trust me, those two games are very different from a style perspective, very different from an overall mechanic standpoint. But for whatever reason, the graphics kind of evoked a similar feeling. And by the way, I loved EverQuest. I was really into EverQuest when it came out for years. I played that along with my brother and cousin, and we played a ton of EverQuest. So that is probably one of my favorite games of all time. And as I was playing through Shadowcaster, I kind of got that same evocative feeling. It's not that it's the best graphics in the world. It's not that it's the most detailed environments or the most detailed characters and items or things like that. But for whatever reason, the overall style kind of evoked that sense of just exploration. I guess that's the best way to put it. You didn't necessarily know what you were going to see over the horizon, what you were going to see as you turned a corner. But the graphics were well done, and so much so that it felt like you were exploring a strange world. And because of that, it just really grabbed me and sucked me in. So I have no complaints about the graphics. I really liked the design and how they built the graphics into the game world. From a sound and music standpoint, I actually enjoyed the music a great deal, and I felt that the soundtrack meshed well with the environment. Now, you're not going to get CD audio here. These are not going to be fully orchestrated soundtracks or anything like that. But honestly, you don't need it. In fact, I find that MIDI-based audio, so that's the more synthesis or sample-based audio that's often found in earlier computer titles, that's oftentimes more evocative than orchestral arrangements from this time, because composers using synthesized sounds really needed to work to get you to believe you were hearing a well-composed piece of music and to really evoke the feelings that they were trying to convey within a particular scene or a particular soundtrack. You will hear the combat theme a lot, by the way, because there's a heck of a lot of combat in the game. So it's a good thing that the particular combat theme in the game is a pretty good one. This is another area where the music, once again, kind of reminded me of EverQuest a little bit. And I know EverQuest came out way later than this one, but it had a similar kind of feel. And once again, with both games being MIDI-based soundtracks and trying to evoke that sense of wonder, that sense of just emotion as you're navigating the world and sense of exploration, it just meshed really well with the game. The sound effects, they were unremarkable, but they served their purpose. No real complaints from a sound perspective. I really liked the music. The sound effects were just kind of there, but don't really have any complaints one way or the other with that. Moving on to the narrative and story. In a nutshell, you find out early in the game that you are not actually a human, but instead you are the descendant of a long line of shapeshifters who have been in an eternal struggle with the forces of darkness in a parallel world. Your grandfather opens a portal to this parallel world, which you go through as your journey begins. Unfortunately, at the very beginning of the game, you have no idea how to shapeshift because you've lived as a human your whole life, which is why you need to reacquire those skills as you explore the game world. So that is the overarching storyline. Basically, you are a shapeshifter in constant struggle. You just find out that you are part of this race of beings that's supposed to deal with the forces of darkness, and now you're thrust into the world to deal with those forces and try to save the day. Other than that overarching storyline, there's really not a ton of story throughout the rest of the game. It really is purely an action RPG with a lot of hack and slash gameplay. That being said, there are some occasions as you work your way through the game where you meet other NPCs and can have short conversations with them. Most of those interactions, though, are just about adding some flavor to the game rather than driving deeper story elements. This is not a game with a super deep RPG story full of companions, villains, and hidden lore. But I will say, for what it is, it kind of works. It, once again, is around the whole overall concept of streamlining and making this an RPG for the masses versus having a ton of complex systems and interactions. If you're going into this looking for a very deep experience, it's not quite as deep as what you would want. But if you're going into it looking for a fun time and just trying to have some nice light RPG-ish kind of gameplay and have some action to go along with it, it does work, and the story supports that kind of game. Talking about the playability and controls, I will say the controls were certainly a little bit dated. Navigation doesn't use any sort of traditional mouse look or other creature comforts that we've come to expect in modern titles. You basically navigate the world using your mouse and keyboard, with either being usable for both movement as well as taking action in the game world. Even though it wasn't quite as straightforward or simple from a controls perspective, and it does take a little bit of getting used to, once you get through that brief feeling out period, you will acclimate to the controls pretty quickly. And once you acclimate, and once you kind of have that feel for how to play the game and how the controls work and when to do what and how to change your verticality and how to duck and how to shapeshift and use all the different skills and how to do all that kind of stuff. And I rattled off a ton of things just then. But once you figure out how to effectively use the tools that are available to you, it does become a pretty enjoyable experience playing the game. And even though the controls are dated, even though it feels like you're playing an older title, once you get past that, once you get through it and you get a little bit more used to the overall controls and the experience, it is an enjoyable time. So overall, how did it feel to play Shadowcaster today versus when it was released? I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good game. It was a good experience. It felt old school, but in a very satisfying way. You know how sometimes when you play an older game, and you know you're playing an older game, it's not like you're going to mistake it for a modern title, but for whatever reason, that older or that more classic kind of experience just grabs you. And it just creates a certain degree of satisfaction in the gameplay and how all the elements of the game fit together that sometimes modern titles can't even replicate. This is that. Shadowcaster gives you that experience. Because the developers didn't have the technology that we have today, they had to really work to create an overarching feeling that pervaded the visual, auditory, and control elements of the game, and they did a great job in creating the feeling of navigating and slashing through a dungeon environment with many pitfalls, traps, creatures, and hazards. That being said, I do have some critiques. The difficulty of the game can sometimes be a bit challenging, especially in certain areas of the game. The beginning in particular, I thought I was doing something really wrong because I kept dying at the very first fight of the game. It was actually getting a little frustrating. I was trying to play the game, and this is before you have any shapes. So this is still while you're just your base humanoid form as Kurt. And the very first enemy that you encounter, I was dying repeatedly. And I started thinking, is this game broken? Is something going on here that I just can't figure out what to do? Eventually, I realized that you have to actually move around during combat and click rapidly, and I do mean rapidly, to attack. That was a hard lesson that I learned relatively quickly and is just one prime example of how older titles like this don't hold your hand much, if at all. Continuing to talk about some of my critiques, later areas in the game would require certain shape-shifted forms to be used in order to progress. And let me tell you, some of those forms, like we were talking about, are very squishy, almost to the point of being unusable. And in fact, one of my major critiques, and this might have been just the way I play games or I played this game, is that certain forms felt pretty close to useless except under very specific circumstances. And as we were talking about before, I pretty much gravitated towards a few main forms. Maiorin was my melee combat form, and that was pretty much my go-to for most of the game. That eventually got replaced by the Sair, which was the flying dragon, and the reason I did that is because it had a very powerful melee-based attack. And then finally, when I got the Grost, which had very powerful melee and defense, I pretty much used that for the rest of the game. You can kind of see the pattern in my overall playstyle in that I used melee fighters almost exclusively. I did try to use the other forms, but for the most part, I got destroyed, or at a minimum, it was much more difficult. There, for me, wasn't really any incentive to use the other forms, except for specific areas of the game that required them, or to use certain skills like healing that the Khan class was able to do, or the mana regeneration that you can get if you were switched over to Kurt. Because when I play RPGs or games in general, I try to hoard pretty much everything I find. So if I find a mana potion or if I find a health potion, I try to not use them if at all possible, because my thought is I'm going to need them eventually and I'll probably need them on some boss fight. So I want to make sure that I have them when I need them, so I'm not going to use them for the most part during the normal playthrough. That's probably a really backwards way to play games, and I recognize that, but that's generally speaking the way I play most of those games. I am a hoarder in these kinds of games, so when I would need to heal, I would switch over to the Khan class. If I needed to regenerate mana, I would switch back over to Kurt. But that would be the only time, or those would be the only times that I would use those forms. Most of the time, I was just using my melee-based forms to get through the game and fight the enemies. I do feel like there could have been a better balance between the forms, but once again, that might just be me or the general way that I play these kind of games. Overall, though, Shadowcaster was a solid experience, and one that holds up even today, as long as you put some time into learning the ropes. And I do want to just give a brief commentary on classic gaming in general. A lot of older titles required a degree of commitment to really enjoy. They are not, for the most part, sit down and play experiences. If you're going to play one of these games, you should expect to die, and you should expect to learn. I can see the immediate experience that I had with this game being a turnoff to many people, because I literally died to the easiest first monster I encountered multiple times before I figured out what to do. Once I got it, though, the whole experience became very rewarding, and I enjoyed the game. But I did have to get over that hurdle, and many other classic games have similar hurdles to conquer, whether because of control schemes, gameplay mechanics, or just overall lack of direction. They can be incredibly fun, but you need to be ready to make a bit of an investment to truly feel that fun. So, overall verdict, where does Shadowcaster sit? I just want to say, this was a great game. It was definitely a turning point for the action RPG genre back in the early 90s. Today, it is still a blast to play, though there were some elements that aged a bit in comparison to what we're used to in modern titles. For that reason, for me, this is a perfect example of a golden oldie. You should play it, and you'll likely enjoy it. I will say you do need to invest some time into it before you'll truly have fun, but if you do, if you invest that time, you'll find a rewarding experience with more complex gameplay than first meets the eye. I recommend everyone try the title at some point in their gaming careers, and while you might be able to tell pretty easily that it's an early example of an action RPG, I'm betting you'll have some fun along the way. That was our episode on Shadowcaster. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out and let me know how I'm doing, or give me suggestions for future episodes or talk about prior episodes, I would love to hear from you. There are a couple of ways you can reach out to me. You can either send me an email at classicgamingtoday@gmail.com, or you can send me a note on Twitter. I have the handle @classicgamingt. So feel free to reach out. I am legitimately interested in hearing what you think. Before we call it for the week, I want to mention that our next episode is going to be focused on Dragon's Lair. So if anybody has any particularly fond or not so fond memories of that game, feel free to write in. I definitely want to have the discussion. I want to know what you all are thinking about the game as we start talking about it next week. At the same time, I recognize that this podcast is pretty much available anywhere that podcasts live, and it would be great if you could leave us a review on whatever podcast aggregation engine of choice that you use. This is not about bolstering star counts. It's not about trying to harvest a ton of five-star reviews, though if you feel it's warranted, I would love to get them because, hey, that means we're doing something right. But I legitimately want to know what everybody is thinking because I want to create the best possible podcast this can be. And the only way to do that is to make sure that we're getting that feedback and that the content that I'm creating is the content that you all want to listen to. We are still growing, we are still learning, we are still developing. That will probably never end. The more feedback we get, the better that we'll be able to make this podcast and make it something that is truly special for everyone. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode, which is going to be focused on Dragon's Lair. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.